Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
It's easy for me to talk to anybody, any place in this country, and say, we were founded by the Ball family, and say, of the Ball Jar, because so far I've never met anybody who doesn't know what a Ball Jar is.
Karen Vincent works with Ball Jars at her job in Muncie, Indiana. We learn about the history of the first family of food preservation, using drones as a way to peek inside industrial livestock operations. Harvest Public Media tells us how farmers are reacting. The My Farm Roots series introduces us to growers across the country. Today we travel to Colorado. In Indiana, it's cooperation over competition amongst Hoosier winemakers. And for our meal, a soup that uses potatoes, leeks, and something special from the woods. Food stories that hit this week's headlines with Lou Ann Johnson.
Those involved with a cattle processing facility are facing criminal charges after a grand jury indicted them for processing meat condemned by USDA inspectors. Petaluma, California-based Rancho Feeding Corporation allegedly processed condemned and cancerous cows, along with healthy cows, when inspectors weren't looking. Rancho co-owner Jesse J. Amaral Jr., the foreperson, and the yard person have been charged with 11 felony counts, including mail fraud, conspiracy, and placing adulterated and misbranded meat into interstate commerce. The mass recall was first announced in February and affected nearly 8.7 million pounds of beef. The violations took place over the course of 3 years, dating back to mid-2012. Criminal charges are rare in food inspection cases, and even more rare in cases involving meat. It is unlikely that the many farmers in the supply chain affected by the recall will recover their expenses. The USDA has said there isn't any federal funding to help with farmers' losses. California rancher Bill Nyman has been forced to dispose of 30 tons of grass-fed meat because of the recall. Nyman held out hope the federal investigation would clear him to sell some of the estimated $400,000 worth of meat, but he eventually had to dump it. Rancho Feeding Corporation closed in February after the recall was announced. And in Nebraska, farmers say they're left with about $9 million in unpaid claims when a grain elevator failed in the town of Pierce. It looks as if farmers' losses could eventually top $4 million. Without a financial safety net to depend on, farmers are watching this case in eastern Nebraska. They're looking for lessons in order to avoid another massive financial wreckage in the future. All over the Midwest, farmers sell their harvest through local grain elevators. They truck their crop to the elevator, where it is weighed and readied for transport. Then they wait for a check representing months of work to arrive in the mail. But that didn't happen in Pierce. Regulators from the Nebraska Public Service Commission revoked the Pierce Grain Elevator's license to operate in March after it became clear the owner no longer had the funds to pay off expenses. The elevator had defaulted on a pair of loans and ran out of money. Farmers who did business with the Pierce operation filed claims for $9.7 million. Selling the corn and soybeans seized after the closure will only raise about half that amount. Read more about this story at harvestpublicmedia.org. We collect food stories like these on our website, eartheats.org.
We keep you informed on Twitter and Facebook all day, every day. Find us by searching for Earth Eats. Lou Ann Johnson, thanks.
You're welcome.
The military is using drones in combat zones worldwide. But closer to home, unmanned aerial vehicles are being used in a different kind of battle. Animal welfare activists want to turn their drone cameras toward big livestock operations. But many farmers aren't welcoming the eye in the sky. Harvest Public Media's Peggy Lowe reports.
The video opens with a long shot of some beautiful snow-covered mountains. But in the foreground is a large red building with white steam or smoke rising from the side. The two shooting the cell phone video are breathless. They see a downed cow outside a slaughterhouse.
It's a cow.
He's alive,
that bulldozer.
Yes,
he's alive.
The video is being shot by Amy Meyer, a 25-year-old woman who was documenting alleged animal abuse outside a Utah slaughterhouse last year. She became the first person in the U.S. prosecuted under a controversial new law that bars recording in a livestock operation while trespassing or going undercover. Meyer wasn't so undercover. The meat plant owner ultimately pulls up, and Meyer continues to videotape it.
Okay, but you cannot videotape my property from public property, so I'm asking you to stop. Now I'll leave and call the cops and have them do that for me.
The case has focused a spotlight on the new laws. Called ag gag by its critics, they are aimed at silencing whistleblowers who try to expose abuses at the large slaughterhouses or livestock operations.
Hi, my name is Will Potter. I'm an independent journalist based in Washington, D.C., and I want to talk to you about a new project I'm really excited about.
Enter Will Potter with a video of his own. This is from his Kickstarter campaign. He's raised $75,000 for Drone on the Farm, a project aimed at flying a camera over what he calls factory farms. He wants to document potential abuses and fly around the ag gag laws.
These laws are meant to keep consumers in the dark. So the obvious question is, what is Big Ag trying to hide?
Potter sees the effort as a way to circumvent such regulations in at least seven states, including Iowa, Kansas, and Missouri, and to also show aerial views of the pollution often centered around those operations.
I've met Mr. Potter on several occasions.
That's Emily Meredith, a spokeswoman for the Animal Ag Alliance, a coalition of farm and commodity groups like the pork producers and the cattlemen.
And I think he's really seen that this space of criticizing the food and agriculture industry is a very trendy space to be in, and I think he's really hitched his wagon to that.
Meredith says the laws act as a deterrent to the activists, who she calls the detractor community, people using deceptive practices, she says, to spread misinformation. She's also not a fan of the term ag gag.
You know, I think that the farm protection legislation and different bills that have been introduced is trying to give farmers who have been victimized by these groups some sort of recourse, some sort of protection against kind of their deceptive tactics.
You're free to leave. I'm going to screen charges of criminal trespass on you.
In the Utah case, the cops can be seen on Amy Meyer's video. But the charges against Meyer were later dropped after a prosecutor found evidence that showed she was legally standing on public property while taping the slaughterhouse. Not everyone in farm country defends the laws. Chuck Jolly, president of the Meat Industry Hall of Fame, says he understands why livestock producers are defensive, but he calls the laws incredibly stupid and short-sighted.
I mean, what you're really doing is handing an issue to the anti-ag people and saying, yeah, I've got something to hide and I need laws to protect me.
Jolly suggests opening up the slaughterhouses, letting consumers go through and learning what the process really looks like. That way, he says, people can make decisions about what to eat based on the facts, not fear.
Having been in most of those plants, there's some stuff that, you know, soft-hearted people won't want to see, but at the same time, that's real life. That's how meat gets put on the table, and people need to understand that.
Angry internet commenters call activists terrorists. Jolly takes a lighter tone, offering Potter some advice. He might not want to fly his drone over farm country during duck season, Jolly says, as some farmers may mistake it for meat. Peggy Lowe, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration focused on issues of food, fuel, and field. More stories like this one at harvestpublicmedia.org. Tis the season for food preservation. Cucumbers become pickles, tomatoes turn into sauce, watermelon rinds are candied. Josephine McRobbie of Traditional Arts Indiana explores the one thing that makes canning, pickling, and other methods of food preservation possible, the container.
Muncie, in East Central Indiana, is deeply associated with the legacy of the Ball family, for whom Ball State University is named. Though the Ball Corporation is no longer centered in Muncie, it was a giant in the community and economy for over 100 years. Now it's a large part of local heritage, centered at the Minnetrista Cultural Center. Karen Vinson is the director of collections for Minnetrista. Among other items, Karen supervises 700 or 800 ball jars and other jars made in the area.
It's easy for me to talk to anybody, any place in this country and say, we were founded by the Ball family, and say, of the Ball Jar, because so far I've never met anybody who doesn't know what a Ball Jar is, even if they've never canned.
Karen agreed to show me around the archives.
You know, I come from a long line of women who don't can. But for me, it's the stories that go behind the jar that I think are the really interesting part.
Most of the items in the collection wouldn't go for much money on eBay or at auction. An exception are jars that have been modified to perform some new task.
This might have been a sugar dispenser. We have attachments that you would use as chicken feeders. I've seen them attached to oil cans. There's a historical society near here that has an iron lung from the TB epidemic there's a ball jar on it that is actually part of the mechanism.
Minnetrista also facilitates food preservation in their community through educational workshops, where groups learn the history of home canning, practice the hot water method, and take home a jar of their finished product. I stopped by a pre-workshop cook session at Minnetrista, where educational staff were working on a test run of a champagne blush jelly. Educator Ashley Lichtenberger and visitor services manager Tanya Brock ran me through the game plan.
We just combined the two juices. There's lemon juice and raspberry juice. And then you have to let that boil with the pectin. And then you need to let it boil, and then you add in the sugar. And then you bring it to a boil and let it boil for about a minute. Then after that, then you add in your champagne. And then you put it in a processing water bath, which is the thing that makes it, preserves it, so that it seals the jars and all of that.
The champagne blush jelly might seem like an unusual choice, but it was picked for a reason.
In our canning workshops, we are trying to get people educated on a variety of levels. So whether that's the novice who's never even seen anyone can, or the person who's been canning for 70 years, and then we sprinkle in the history and the art. We try to highlight modern recipes, for example, like the champagne blush jelly, obviously a more modern recipe than mince meat, for example. So that is in response to trying to keep what we're doing very relevant, but with a nice nod to the traditional canning method.
Tanya, who's from Plainfield, Indiana, has been running canning workshops on and off since 1999 and has canned her whole life with periods of inactivity.
I can remember making grape jelly with Mom, and it was just part of what you did. And then when I started here, I don't know, 13 years ago, and I can remember my very first day calling my mom going, oh my goodness, I'm working for a place that has ball jars on display. Like, it was just everyday items, and I thought, really? As romantic as it sounds to say that I've been canning my whole life, obviously I wasn't cognizant of what I was doing. It was just, yeah, something that you did. But then bringing all that to fruition, working here, and realizing that, yeah, this actually is a way that people have been surviving over time and providing for themselves.
Thanks to Josephine McRobbie for that story. Traditional Arts Indiana explores Hoosier food traditions through their series Second Servings. Find more interviews at traditionalartsindiana.org. Coming up.
I can't tell you the number of times I've seen young cooks throw away or waste a lot of the leek. And it really is, I mean, you pay as much for the top green part of the leek as you do for the bottom part, so you might as well use the whole thing.
Waste not, want not with Chef Daniel Orr. You can use almost the entire leek in his soup recipe. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Chef Daniel Orr has all the ingredients ready for a potato leek soup. Maybe soup isn't to your taste for these hot August days. So here's another idea for all those leeks you're pulling from your garden right now.
In France, they'll actually make salad of the leeks. What they do is cut the bottom part of the leek, which is the white part, and it's the most tender. And when you look at it, you should see the round stratification, almost like the rings of a tree. And then you're going to cut the whole leek in half lengthwise. You can see here, Annie, how there's some dirt in the leaves there. So you always want to make sure you really clean that out. Take off the first couple layers of the exterior of the leek. And in France, they would cut that off, so that's about a 5 to 6 inch piece. Then you would blanch that until it's tender. And then you'd just serve that with a simple vinaigrette. And it's called leek poireau vinaigrette, which means leeks in a vinaigrette. Sounds a lot better in French.
Daniel Orr uses every single piece of his ingredients, onion skins to make stock, celery leaves for garnish. That tough part of the leek, he definitely uses that.
I can't tell you the number of times I've seen young cooks throw away or waste a lot of the leek. And it really is, I mean, you pay as much for the top green part of the leek as you do for the bottom part, so you might as well use the whole thing. All right, so we're going to take about quarter cup of butter, and we're putting that in a nice big soup pot, and we're going to add our diced onions. All right, we're adding the leeks. They've been roughly chopped. We've got celery, and you can go ahead and use the leaves and everything. So many people throw away celery leaves, and to me, they're one of the most delicious flavors. Put those in salads, garnish things with them. They're really, really flavorful, and they have a very unique savory quality to them. We're going to let this cook down until the onions become translucent and tender. Now, to make this recipe a little more complex, we're going to add a little bit of fennel seed, which will give it a slight anise flavor, some cayenne pepper. We're going to add some white wine, a couple cloves of garlic. I'm going to add maybe a couple more cloves of garlic. We're going to add our potatoes, 2 quarts of water. Okay, bring that to a boil. Cook it until everything's nice and tender. Probably take about 20 minutes to a half an hour.
So far, this has been a pretty standard potato leek soup. But here is where Daniel adds a Southern Indiana touch. Chanterelle mushrooms are starting to pop up in the woods these days. They're a perfect addition to this recipe. Colorful, toothsome, and full of flavor. He's adding them after smoothing out the soup in the blender.
All right, you can see it's nice and smooth, creamy. All right, we're going to point this out. I like to use a nice, broad based bowl so you can really see that nice creaminess. And now I'm going to decorate it with the sauteed chanterelles. I'm going to garnish that with some leeks in the middle. And that is our crème de poireau aux chanterelles. Creamy potato leek soup with chanterelle mushrooms. Bon appetit!
This recipe and tips for finding and cooking chanterelles and other wild shrooms at eartheats.org. The reporters at Harvest Public Media spend time speaking with farmers and recording stories of rural American life. The series My Farm Roots is a collection of those stories. Luke Runyon presents this week's profile.
Carrie Williams' family vacations weren't to Europe or to beaches in Florida. Her family got away from it all on the farm. Now she works for Farm Aid. And when I spoke to her at a crowded open-air market in Denver, she said those good times with her family stick with her.
I'm Carrie Williams. I grew up in Grand Island, Nebraska, in the south central part of the state. Have since moved out to Denver and still work remotely for Farm Aid. My parents, both of them, grew up on their family farms, and one in Lexington, one in Elwood. A lot of the times when we were headed out to the farm, it was for a holiday or for summer vacation, and we would generally be there at a time when my cousins were all there as well. So we were kind of like a little swarm of bees. There were 10 of us on both sides of the family, and we just kind of run around together. And I bounced off of a couple of electric fences in my day. And so I remember that frenetic energy, but also the smells. The smell of the farm was, I guess, probably something that would turn a lot of people off if they weren't used to it. But actually, the smell of cow manure, just that smells like home to me. I love that. So that was never a problem to me. And the smell of the horse barn and the smell of the animals themselves, just that warmth, was something that was really incredible. Once my brother was stuck in, I guess it was a tack barn, by a rooster. And he was being chased around the yard first, and then he ran into the tack barn, slammed the door, and tried going out the back door, back up to the house. He was basically being circled by the rooster. So anytime he opened a door or a window, there was the rooster, ready to jump on him. So eventually he called my mom on the phone from the tack barn, and she came out to save him and ended up having to throw a blanket on top of the rooster, opening the door and then running for their lives. Goofy memories like that. My brother was pretty small until he was old. Not very tough. I really miss that feeling and that life and where it transports me to. And the memory of family being together. There was a year when I was just a little rugrat, and we received the Farm Family of the Year Award in Gosper County, Nebraska. There was a lot of pride in that, you know, that we had had the farm at that point for 125 years. Now it's over 150. And thinking about our history there and how we grew up there and where our roots were.
Luke Runyon and the entire team at Harvest Public Media have collected stories from farmers all over the country. Read and listen to more My Farm Roots features at harvestpublicmedia.org. Last year, the Indiana Uplands region of South Central Indiana was named an official American Viticulture Area, or AVA, giving some federal recognition to the distinct winemaking that's been happening in this region for over 40 years. 9 Indiana wineries call the Uplands region home. Each year, they gather at an event called Uncork the Uplands to celebrate. This year, that event took place at the Creek Bend Vineyard of Oliver Winery. Earth Eats' Mark Chilla was in attendance to learn about the community of winemaking that happens in the Indiana Uplands.
If you're anything like me, when you think wine, you think Napa Valley in California, the Bordeaux region of France, and maybe not South Central Indiana.
People should think of Indiana because the first successful commercial wine production in the country was in Indiana.
That's Jim Butler of Butler Winery giving me a little history lesson.
And that was in Vivi, Indiana. It was a group of Swiss settlers. They settled in Kentucky first, and then they bought land in...
There were history lessons abound at the 4th annual Uncork the Uplands event, an event that celebrates the 9 wineries on the Indiana Uplands Wine Trail.
The upland area is completely different. The soils are different. Our climate is different.
That's Tim Huber, owner of Huber Orchard Winery and Vineyards in Starlight, Indiana.
The varieties of grapes that I can grow versus most people in the state of Indiana, they don't have the ability to grow those varieties. So
having the ability to grow different varieties has worked well, because then the wine makers in the Indiana uplands have been able to adapt to the changing tastes of Indiana wine drinkers.
When we first started the winery, we had 80, 85, 90% people were drinking sweeter wines. That has switched dramatically here in the last 15 years. We have more dry reds on the market than we do all sweet wines combined.
All of this comes out of the unique topography of this land, which differs from the rest of the farming land in Indiana. Here's Butler again.
These are non-glaciated soils, so these are fairly lean soils. They're not real rich, and that's what you want for growing grapes. You don't want to put grapes on good corn ground where it gets 200 bushels to acre. There's too much nitrogen. So these poorer soils lend themselves to that.
And it's not just the soil. It's the weather, too.
You know, the summers are good. We have good heat in the summer, and it's not too cold in the winter. Now, I take exception with the last winter.
Yes, the bitter cold of last winter.
Polar vortex was a big hit this year.
Those cold temperatures in January affected many of the crops in the Midwest.
Not among vineyards, though.
That was Bernie Parker, the vineyard manager of Oliver's Creek Bend Vineyard. the vines fared surprisingly well through the polar vortex. That's not to say that some varieties of grapes, like the Traminette, weren't hit.
Traminette is a state grape. Pretty much all of the wineries are making a Traminette wine. The cold snap here, it came through moderately well. A lot of the vines are going to have a lot less fruit on them than they normally would. We're probably talking about a quarter.
But with so many varieties, all with different levels of cold hardiness, it really wasn't that much of a loss overall. Here's Huber again.
Didn't do as well, and other varieties have done extraordinarily well. We're probably going to be somewhere in the 85 to 90% of crop.
Once again, welcome to the fourth annual Uncorked Uplands.
This first wine that we're pouring is dry, barrel-aged French oak.
This year's Uncork the Uplands was particularly special because it was also cause for celebration. Just the day before, the wineries received the results from the 2014 Indy International Wine Competition.
This is kind of our medal hall.
Here's Jim Pfeiffer. He owns Turtle Run Winery and is also the president of the Indiana Uplands Wine Trail. He's showing off a list of this year's winners.
Every winery that participated by putting wines in won. Yeah, for instance, French Lick, they were 6 for 6. We were 3 for 4. It makes you feel good when your wines are holding up to the best of the world.
You can chalk up much of the recent success of the Indiana Uplands wines to the winemaker's sense of community. Growing wine in this region, as I found, is a shared enterprise. Here's Pfeiffer.
One of the neat things about the Indiana Uplands Wine Trail is when we have our meetings, a lot of times they spin out into wine quality, grape quality, not issues, but ideas. What are you doing? Things like that.
So even though these wineries are competing with one another in wine competitions and for sales in the region, they don't see it as competition. You may say that the real reason behind the Indiana Uplands success comes not from the soil or the weather, but from the shared support of this community of winemakers.
So with those shared thoughts, we're able to collectively grow our industry and keep us on par. That's why we're able to get so many medals.
Mark Chilla, witnessing the community of winemaking in the Indiana Uplands. See pictures from Uncork the Uplands at eartheats.org. A big thanks to our Earth Eats crew, Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Lauren Glappa, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepherd, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thanks for being with us today. I'm Annie Corrigan.